evaluating this protection process. And Bass Subservation, because he's done work on smoke screens during the war, he refused. And then he came back and said, we've got to have some other bidders on this project. We want some independent bid. So he came to me and he said, listen, I'm going to be aware of how about helping us put this together. What we will do is we will double all the costs, so we're sure we won't get this. And so we turned it in, and both it comes back, and they decided to give it to us. There were lots of repercussions over this, because we were the high bidder. But they really thought it sounded like we had a different approach. They really wanted some. These people said, well, White Hollow was on that work. They wanted to get some new blood into this project. So I didn't know what this was all about. And it was really trying to predict how much of the radiation comes from nuclear weapons hits the ground through smoke screens. And it was a frantic period of learning and calculating. And we discovered this was an incredible computer problem. Computers were just coming along. And so we were continually pushing at the frontier of using computers in this work. Our first computers, IBM card program computers, we used to have to wire to solve this problem on the back of the board. I mean, they essentially just processed a bunch of cards, of course, but all of the calculations were done by an analog type encoder to the MBR601 computer. At that time, John Carr was here. Was there, and they were building a new computer. He said this is just a problem to solve that. But it turned out the computer never really got plenty of time for us to do anything. But we did get solutions to that problem of scattering through the atmosphere, and the problem is we had all students who didn't have classification, and this was classified super secret. So we took the problem on. This is the sunlight coming through a cloud. It's identical to the same problem anyway. So all these unclassified students are working on this sort of thing, not knowing what we did. So it's kind of ridiculous. They had to buy all our papers and notes away, and I did not take those few at that time of night, but we had security. So Subservation never did come back.
Just stayed in Monsanto?
He stayed in Monsanto. He came back briefly, but then he went to Oklahoma. And so I was left with all this, and I sort of inherited all that research.
Well, quite a bit of your early research dealt with radiation. And I counted 17 articles that you published, perhaps in the first, not even the first 10 years.
Yeah, that all came out of that. We were developing theoretical methods. It was a very exciting thing. Chandra St. Packer just got the Nobel Prize, and this was our consultant on the project. We met with every month. And so he had done one of the elementary solutions of this kind. So it was very exciting. The people we were dealing with. I'm afraid that some of this work that they're talking about out in people being contaminated out in Nevada is not my fault, but there's a paper by Schleicher there one time, and somehow in a casual discussion with a bunch of generals from this operation, they said, what would happen if one of these things went off in a cloud? And I, off the tip of my tongue, said nothing. The cloud will still be there when the atomic bomb is gone. They thought this was absolutely nonsense. They're long specialists. I said, absolutely, we thought about that one day. It won't affect anything. So we wrote a paper on it, which we published, although I probably didn't care as much. You would never know, it never really mentions the word nuclear, of course, the paper. But that's the paper slasher. And so they ran a test to prove we were right. And I remember the phone call, and you know, this guy says, it's still there. There is that when you, all that radiation goes very little that hits the droplets, and what hits the droplets just dumps to the air. So the only way that you can evaporate the droplets is to heat all the air up. Very inefficient method. So the bomb, which only lasts a second or two, the air never gets hot before the droplets. And the shock wave goes to nothing. This happens, the droplets are still there. And of course, they work.
Well, while we're still on the topic of radiation scattering, you publish mostly under the topic with Chiao Ming Chu and G.C. Clark. Would you like to elaborate a bit on their effect on you, Vice President?
Yeah, Chiao Ming Chu was started out as a doctoral student in electrical engineering in Michigan. And we had two desk computers, the type you punch and do.
No,
that's what we were doing the work on initially. And he came by and asked if he could use those. And we said yes, and what was he doing? Well, he was working on a radar scattering problem. And so we started out talking, and we found out not only was he really working on the same problem, but that's why he was trying to solve. So we developed a tremendous rapport and interaction. I did research with him for maybe 5 or 10 years. He never had classification, which was always a touchy problem. But he was a true genius, and a lot of the things that he did were great contributions to this. He was really intuitive mathematician. He was trying to find ways. I remember you and Ben mentioned this at the things that he was going to scan and everything. I would talk with him, and he said, well, he's got 10 years working on this problem because it's consolidated.
Latex droplets were the water, and the background, the water, was the air. We simulated the same index of refraction. We always worried the particles were very close together, whether that had any influence where the power particles were far apart. So he was going to study that, but it's still uncompleted. It's not a total result problem. It's incredibly complicated.
You had mentioned previously that the funding for the research was before the one most in the book. Well, it did not involve the federal government.
Yeah.
The he was maybe my first student. He started the creek about 1952 or 3. And Bill came with that problem. We wanted to study how to put hydrogen oxygen back together again without any kind of a reactor that would be, have any moving parts. So it could be part of the nuclear reactor. If you formed hydrogen oxygen, you just make it back into water. So it wasn't our idea. Somebody had the idea to put a platinum catalyst in.
And then you have a condenser. So we thought, well, what rate would it go? So we devised this circular reactor in which it would, the hydrogen oxygen would rise, react with the platinum, and that would heat it up, it would circulate, and then it would go past the condenser and go back in. So that was that problem that we studied. And that was, Bill was the first person who ever solved the problem of natural convection using a computer. And the computer we had, which was the IBM 601, was not big enough to solve a computer. So we had many equations and energy equations. We used the experimental temperatures to solve the energy equations, we used the experimental velocity to solve the energy equations. So we knew the equations, and they agreed with his data. So it wasn't a complete solution, but we knew the equations. Because, you know, people were not sure at that time. Did these equations really know the governance? And the next student that came along was David Kellogg. We had a bigger computer, and he solved it. And that's the real first
ever. This is still cited very frequently.
Paper 43, 1961, Computation and Natural Convection by Finite Differences. In fact, both those papers are cited in Vaughan's History of Mathematics and Chemical Engineering as vintage report, not as
Kellum's invented many of the methods that are still used to this day for numerical methods.
Were you using finite difference methods because that didn't cut down on the number of, or on the size of the computing?
We had these special differential equations to solve. We didn't know any other way to solve them, and I had studied in mathematics that it was possible in conduction problems, and we thought, why couldn't we were stupid enough to think we might be able to do it in convection problems. It turned out that in 1928 or something, Baum in England had solved a forced convection problem using this. We were not acquainted with that work for years, so we were completely, at least a new starting point. As far as I know, that paper of Helen's is the first paper ever on this subject.
Well, speaking of the kids, I'd like to know what caused you to have your caused kids. What did you do? What foundation body did you stand for 6 weeks? What did you do previously?
Student I ever who did 4 or 5 fundamental things. David Helms did that. He developed the method for simplifying partial differential equations. He was the first person who ever solved 3-dimensional natural convection problems with super name of his. And he developed the low vector convection method, which is used in all kinds of problems, unless you get the second
right.
Thank you. work which people still cite almost theoretical work. He just worked night and day. He works for, he's now involved in sterling engine work on the vessels in Washington. Peter Albrecht started at the same time. And Peter Albrecht studied forced convection in Germany. And he was the first person in Asia to get his degrees and the transfer and the metal transfer both his doctor, readily precise philosophy and temperature measurements. Those are still also a lot in the whole field.
Peter had a curious career. After he left, he went to work for Upjohn, and then he worked for 3M. He got into biomedical things, went back and became an MD, and he was on the faculty for years in Michigan, practicing engineering, as he said, working on kidney work. But now he's in Washington with the National Institutes of Health. We also keep very close touch with incredible experiments.
And Schleicher was another.
Schleicher was that. Not my doctoral student. He actually was Tribus's doctoral student. But Tribus left. And so this is before I was at my PhD. So although I supervised Schleicher's work, nominally Katz was his doctoral assistant, and he proceeded on right. He did work in that same building.
Thank you.
but it was very slow growing in universities.
Were you called upon by other people in chemical engineering departments as a source of information so that they could introduce computers into their departments?
I don't think so very much. I was trying to think of who else. Leon Lapidus began to work with computers at Princeton after working in SOAR. And Neil Amundsen was doing work with computers very early. There were a lot of people at the time who were very anti-computer. It's hard to believe this, but there were many people going around thinking this is an unfair way to solve problems, and it's dog work, and it's not something that university people should be doing.
It was too crude. Inelegant?
It was just defensive, of course. That's what Katz discovered. That was the heart of the Ford Foundation. Right? They discovered if somebody knew how to use a computer, then they went on to criticize its use. But they didn't know how. They always said it's not relevant. So it was a kind of a defense. And that kind of reaction people did. That was lucky to be pushed into the that was an effect. You see, I had a mathematics background that almost nobody else in chemical engineering had, and I was sort of looking for some place to put it to use.
That's right.
That was my unique characteristic. So I looked at problems of that kind.
Sure, and it must have been exciting to have the computers around as well, so that you could combine the expertise in applying mathematics to certain problems with the brute force to crank out solutions that other people couldn't do.
Of course, it was agonizing. Those big computers we had then were less than these kind now.
Yeah.
Do you realize that the computer I have in my hand will solve problems better than the computer, almost the problem that Helen's had a computer. He may have had the first computer, the first one of all those people had a computer better than a handheld computer of the best type. It's just incredible.
It is surprising.
It was terribly hard to learn to use these things. You had to program all in machine language. You know, two students at the University of Michigan really developed Fortran 4. Two doctoral students. The name was Buzz Gallo, who's now dean of the Literary College of Michigan. And Dean Harden, who's head of the Princeton Computer Center. The mathematics department decided this was an unsuitable mathematics for him. He decided to talk about PhD. And it was called MAD. Michigan algorithm declared to be supplied of all other computer systems. IBM bought it because it was really going to put them in 10,000. Think of everybody. And Brown went and said, if you won't get one with HD, we will create a computer science degree that we will HD because they're in world class with mathematics department. And so they actually got their degrees in mathematics. But that was not considered.
When Helen was doing these things, there was no book that says if you do this, you know, that discovered often, almost all of the fundamental methods we have used today. Many of the rediscovered mathematicians already have done this, so we know that. What does, with Ellington Park and the other two of them, before I begin, because of the personal part of that,
very frustrated in the university because you work with such poor equipment and so little of a technical assistance. And so, the copy of the experiment work taking the time. Whereas, theoretically, you may have better support, people support, maybe I'm sure better from the university. You can always find someone from the university. You may not have anybody to help the existing DuPont. But experimentally, you got a problem. Somebody got a better way to help you. Here, you can put yourself in the way to help you. I think that, those students who have strong desires to be able to spend always in that way, you don't have that. I know, in the early stage, I have to use certain application, but one was testing, what won't you have to experimentation? I think that only one of my students ever did not do any experimental work. I know which it was.
I would have to look through all of this to see this, but we always felt we had to prove that what we did was right. And, you know, we were always solving equations. Does it really do that in the real world? Are we in a regime where that happens?
Not always as dramatically as that explosion in the cloud, but
it are all right to have an effect upon your stress and chemical stress. It was a model of looking, but it brought out and suggested that that need be done. I suppose our had more influence on my career than any other single person. We sat and talked more about philosophy of research, about philosophy of education. He was a brilliant idea man who never finished anything. And, so I sort of went around with him. We would rattle things and I would actually go do it. But I don't know that he was not terribly mathematically inclined. He was capable of doing this. Strange person, but he was an eclectic person. He liked to see first solutions to things, but he got bored with things that were philosophically. It's too bad we lost him in the sense of profession. He always, not only put his finger out, say, I was a man by the river, so he always had an idea about the power of the right, that he would be repressible. He also had to have a new job and a new challenge about every 6 months. He could never keep on doing the same thing. And he sort of went out of the way to do it at the university. He hadn't done before. And so he got the offer to be director of research for ARCO in Philadelphia. He came here as director of research for about 4 years. He really, as far as I know, turned over the organization. He had a big impact. Then something happened in the present class that he was out. He was originally vice president of
where he was dean of the business administration.
Business
administration. And then he went to Washington with the National Academy of Science about 15 years ago, and he's been there ever since, and as far as I can see, has had no impact on anything. I've seen him on television a few times. He runs some program called The Forum, in which they get distinguished people to discuss drugs with something else. But this is clearly a sure waste of his intellect. I see him.
It is almost 5 or 6, and you have to go. This is probably a good place to start. Stop off.